Take two.
Okay, well, I'm still Audrina Finagra, and I'm still a writer, and this is my cat, Whimsy. And...
But no longer an artist?
Yeah, I'm still an artist.
Oh, okay. All right, let's see.
Hard to remember all those things.
Well, thank you ever so much for taking the time to meet with us.
Really?
It's a real honor for us. We like to chat with writers about what their earliest memories were of writing, or their earliest influences or experiments or that sort of thing. Do you have anything that comes to mind? Did you just start writing yesterday?
No, by no means. The first thing that I remember really taking pains over was writing a bunch of limericks and illustrating them. Or there was probably this earlier thing. I remember writing a Halloween poem and folding it up into a little book and illustrating that. I was always trying to make books.
Uh-huh.
Like, it was okay to write something, and it was nice to make a picture, but it was better to have the pictures and the words together and make little books.
Ah.
And so I was always obsessed with trying to do that.
Do you remember anything about the topic, or...?
It's in red ballpoint pen on a piece of scrap typing paper. It's about goblins and people coming out of their graves, and the last line in the poem is, to scare, to scare, to scare. And that's pretty much all I remember about it.
Yeah. You don't still have it?
I have it somewhere, but this house is just a
yeah.
tip in terms of finding anything.
And how old were you then?
Probably in kindergarten, maybe?
Whoa, okay.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. So did you get encouragement from parents and teachers and others or to try more of those sorts of things?
Yeah, my mother is an artist, and her mother as well was very artistic, and so there was always this... I mean, my mother was always making things, and there was just this sense that that's what grown-ups do, is they make stuff. And my mother had been an English major, so our house was always full of books that I had no clue what they were. They were grown-up books.
Yeah.
But my mother was always great about ensuring that there were plenty of art supplies and there were lots of good children's books. She was kind of a genius of acquiring interesting books for us.
Do you remember any specific one that...
I was really into Peter Pan.
Oh, yeah.
I can't remember if I saw the movie first or if we read the book first. It was a very simplified Peter Pan. I mean, later when I read the Barry version, I thought, wow, this is odd.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just seemed odder and odder the more I read it. But, I think the first version I encountered was a pretty stripped-down version with really nice illustrations.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember my response to that was to take a big green marker and draw all over it. And my mother was kind of shocked, but, you know, my goal was like, well, this is really nice, and I think I'll add to it. And in book collecting, there's actually a term for that. It's called extra illustration.
Extra. Extra illustration.
Yeah, and it's where you take existing books and put pictures in them
mm-hmm.
to sort of make them better.
Yeah.
But yeah, my copy of Peter Pan is completely covered in green marker.
Through school, did you continue drawing and writing and... pursuing that?
I went to a really small Catholic school in the 60s and 70s, and we passed a certain grade, I think probably about second or third. We didn't really have art, nor language.
Whoa.
We had, you know, the basics. We had math and social studies, which was kind of history, and we had religion, you know, you couldn't get away from that, and English and all that stuff, but not so much with the art. High school was probably for me like going to colleges for many people because I was getting out of this fairly provincial, tiny Catholic school. I mean, my grammar school had about 250 students from K to 8,
mm-hmm.
so really small. My high school, on the other hand, was a public high school, Evanston Township, and there were about 4,000 students. So it was like, woohoo, we've hit the big time now.
Into the ocean.
Yeah, and they had an art department and a music department and, you know, AP English and all that. So all of a sudden it was this very, what they now would call an enriched environment as opposed to the fairly basic bare bones thing that I had previous. I mean, these days, I think if I was growing up now, somebody would stick me in, like, a magnet school or something. But at mm-hmm. the time, I don't know if I got a better or worse education than I would have gotten going to the local public school, because it's impossible to go back and re-experience my childhood at a public school.
Right.
But, I mean, the result of it, you know, like, I think there were some good things. You know, like, we were being taught reading using phonics.
Mm-hmm.
We all had beautiful handwriting.
Good cursive.
Yeah, people don't seem to get that anymore. My students at Columbia, I was doing an exercise with them that involved mirror writing, and they couldn't do it, a lot of them. They were just like, we don't know how to do connected writing, and I'm like, well, that's sad.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, we diagrammed sentences, and so there was a lot of sort of good underlying tough basics there. But really, when I got to high school,
potatoes of language.
Yeah, yeah, and yeah. And then, you know, some of the teachers were really excellent. You know, I mean, the nuns all left when I was in about third grade. Woohoo! And things kind of, you know, that seemed to improve things generally. But in high school, I just had fantastic teachers. I mean, Bill Wimmer, who was one of my art teachers, at the end of my freshman year, somebody looked at these very Aubrey Beardsley influenced drawings that I was doing. I mean, I was drawing in pen and ink with a quill pen and that whole thing, and somebody said, oh, you should go talk to Mr. Wimmer and, you know, maybe he'll teach you etching.
Oh.
And I said, well, I don't know what that is, but I'll go check this out. And so I went and knocked on the door of the art office, and this sort of owl-like man peered out, and I said, well, I'm looking for Mr. Wimmer. And he said, well, I'm Mr. Wimmer. And I said, well, Becky Heidemann said you would teach me etching, and he said, oh, and he did, and he tutored me after school, because there was no printmaking class.
Uh-huh.
I was born at the tail end of the baby boom, and so all through my schooling, everything was sort of getting smaller,
mm-hmm.
and so a lot of things that had existed didn't exist anymore by the time I got to them. And, you know, he was just unbelievable. I mean, I look back and I think, my God, what incredible devotion to one student who wanted to learn this obscure thing.
Oh, so special. That's what education should be about.
Yeah, I mean, it's the sort of thing that you can't really replicate en masse. I mean, I know myself, there's no way that I can sort of, you know, it would be the equivalent of, you know, artisanal beer or something. I mean, you can't do it in massive quantities, but when you do get that bond between a teacher and a student, it's just life-changing.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so he
absolutely.
Was, he was amazing.
Have you stayed in touch with him?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Very nice. So the art is growing, but the literature, the writing, the love of the word, how's that functioning when you're in high school?
I did a lot of writing. I don't recall. They had some interesting clubs at my high school. There was a creative writing club that it was like an after-school sort of thing, and I joined that when I was a freshman and met a lot of very interesting seniors who were into stuff I knew nothing about, and of course I was always pretending I knew.
Of course.
Yeah, so I was forced to fake an interest in all sorts of things that later became actually interesting to me, and one of the things, when I was a kid, I was always interested in, like, fairy stories and
mm-hmm.
mystery thriller type stuff and, you know, all very science fiction-y sort of things. But I didn't have any systematic approach to reading. It was just gobbling up whatever's in the library.
Mm-hmm.
And so these people I was meeting in the science fiction club, they knew all about it. They were experts on everything. And, you know, so I was doing things like going to the Rocky Horror Picture Show and stuff like that. And, you know, for a 14-year-old, it's kind of like, oh, okay, there's other stuff out there besides what they told us about in tiny Catholic school.
Another world.
Yeah, really, different world.
Yeah.
And, yeah, so at that point, I really could sort of see where I wanted to go, and the answer, of course, to that question was art school. Most of the people I went to the School of the Art Institute with are still making art, which is...
Mm-hmm.
Something. I mean, quite a lot of people who get degrees in visual art, it's just too hard. The world doesn't wanted or rewarded or supported in any way, and so it's very, very tough to do it. And something that has interested me about the writing world is that it supports people better. I mean, you may not make a lot of money, but the path to getting a readership is easier. Even before the internet really opened up self-publishing, I think being a writer was actually an easier row to hoe than being a visual artist. And now all the writer people are sitting there in viewer world hating me. But truly, being a visual artist, there's just hardly a thing out there to encourage it.
It's tough.
Yeah.
When did you decide to actually start writing novels and stories for publication? I mean, you were going to art school, graphic arts, was your fort?
Yeah, you have to fast forward to 1997, uh-huh. At which point I was 34. I had always thought vaguely that I would like to write a novel. I had been writing short stories, but not sending them out. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them I would turn into artist books, that was kind of my primary practice. I was making these limited edition artist books.
Starting with the story and then going back to illustrate?
Starting with a very skeletal story and developing it mostly through pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And I would set the type myself and print it myself and bind it myself, and there would be 10 copies. So that obviously wasn't going to get a huge readership or viewership. I had the idea for The Time Traveler's Wife and initially thought it would be one of these picture books, and the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, pictures are not a good form for indicating jumps in time. I mean, it's really tough to indicate certain things visually.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, well, people will get very confused if I try to do that story in that medium. And I think after I had the idea, I thought about it for all of about half an hour before I realized it would really be better either as a novel in words or as a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And since I in no way had the training or the money to make a movie, I thought, well, you know, I'll just try writing a novel.
Mm-hmm.
And I must say that the development of personal computers and, you know, the software to cut and paste and all that really aided the whole process, because I can't really type properly, and so I used to very laboriously type everything out on typewriters, and then I would go back and, you know, cross everything out and retype it, and it was
white out.
Yeah, it was just sort of a drag.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think if you type 90 words a minute, that maybe wouldn't be as cumbersome, but for somebody who doesn't, it's discouraging. And so the ability to have this manuscript, which was like an organic thing, it was like an organism that you could correct and alter and move around and take whole hunks of it and dump them 30 pages earlier, it really matched the thinking process to the making process.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that for me made a lot more sense and really made it possible to write a 600 page manuscript. Because if I had to retype it every time I changed it, I think I just would have given up.
And you still are using a computer to do your writing? And
oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I will write things out by hand if I'm on a train or,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's not a laptop in front of me, but mostly it's definitely much, much easier for me to write on a computer.
Have you given any thought to where this is going to go in another 10 years? I mean, 10 years ago, or actually 15 years ago, we couldn't have thought of a laptop and traveling around and writing something.
Although I have to say that I used to take my giant monitor and my immense, you know, crazy beige machine and pack it up in my car and go to artists' residencies with it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very determined to have it with me if I was going to get any work done.
Right.
But yeah, it's a heck of a lot easier to just, you know, slide it in your bag and go.
Wow, it's hard to imagine where it's going to be in 20 years.
By then we'll just be, you know, sending novels to each other by telepathy or something. And then you get an e-book that'll, you know, appear on your glasses or something.
Going back for a moment, do you have any favorite inspirational writers, artists that really come to mind to you, that other than Aubrey Beardsley?
Oh, you mean sort of formative people?
Yeah.
Gosh.
Peter Pan and Aubrey Beardsley. What a combination.
I know. Well, Chris, we're talking about the tastes of... I mean, I discovered Aubrey Beardsley when I was 14.
So right.
That's a long time ago. I mean, some of the people who were really interesting to me at the time when I was starting to actually write a novel... at the time, I was really interested in Richard Powers, who I think actually would make a great interview subject for you guys. He's down in Urbana. Richard, he's such an intelligent writer, and his books are very complicated. They're like little machines. They're just so interesting.
Yeah.
And the thing that I found kind of inspiring, he wrote a book called Galatea 2.2, in which he himself is a character, and there's this neural net that kind of comes alive, and he's trying to teach it to read English literature, and, you know, it doesn't quite work out. But, you know, that one and the Goldbug variations just really caught my imagination, and they were just so lovely to read and just so beautifully done. And I just thought, well, I would like to do this. And at the same time, I had just finished reading Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace. That's an amazing book. And one of those turning points, I think, in a lot of people's lives, either as readers or as writers, because he was just so smart, and he really pushed a lot of boundaries in terms of what you could do in terms of fiction. And so reading these two people who were both hyper-intellectual was, I don't know, it just sort of gave me this feeling like, yeah, I could really get into this. This is something I would like to do.
Well, turning for a second to how you write with a computer, and that's, but you sometimes take notes on little pieces. Do you keep a journal?
When I was much younger, I kept a journal, but I don't anymore. And I'm not really sure why I stopped. I mean, it just kind of dropped away. What I do is I think about things for a very long time. A lot of my projects, both the novels and the picture books, take years and years. The Three Incestuous Sisters, which is one of my picture books, took 14 years. Time Traveler took almost 5. Her Fearful Symmetry took about 7. Symmetry, quite a lot of the time there was research, because it's set in a milieu that I didn't know deeply. It's set in London's Highgate Cemetery, and so I got involved and started volunteering. But a lot of it for me is just, at the beginning, just wandering around, kind of playing house in my head and thinking, well, who are these people? And what's the story, and what's going to happen to this person and that person, and how does it affect that other person? And I just kind of have it on a slow boil in my head for a long time. And every now and then I find something out that I think, okay, good to know. The book I'm working on these days has a lot of parts that it's sort of hard to tell right now how certain things relate to each other, and so I'm sort of building structures to get it all to sit so that it means something. So what I'm trying to do is think about the book as a whole and in its parts before I really start to seriously work on it sentence by sentence.
And then it percolates up and you sit down and go to work?
Yeah, or something just gets stuck in my head and I think, okay, I really ought to write that down so I can move on.
Yeah.
But you know, with Symmetry, because everybody was like, oh, so, your second book, what's it about? What are you going to do? And I started sort of pushing at it and trying to write it before it was really
before fully, its time.
Well, yeah, kind of. And so I spent 2 years just kind of putting things down on paper that mostly got tossed because I didn't understand what I was doing. And, yeah, I would just write things and then I would think, well, that's all wrong. So with this one, I'm just kind of letting it... I'm letting myself get it figured out before I bear down on it too hard.
And then once you start, do you have a particular time of the day or do you just sit down and keep going until you're exhausted? And
I just work when I can. I'm fairly deadline-driven, and so this summer, for example, I have a deadline at the end of August for the pictures for a book that I'm working on that's going to become a ballet. And so the story is already pretty much done, and it's the pictures that are taking up all the time, but... It's a time frame that's way, way too short for how I usually work, but in order for the book to come out before the ballet premieres, it has to be on a certain time schedule.
Where will it premiere?
It's being done by the Royal Opera House Ballet, so it's premiering at Covent Garden.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
It's exciting.
Yeah.
Another art form to...
Yeah, fortunately I'm not the choreographer.
Yeah,
I'm collaborating with Wayne McGregor, who's really amazing.
When you write, do you do a lot of revision?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What I do is I work on a scene and revise until I think it's more or less done.
Mm-hmm.
And then I probably don't revisit it until it's time to edit later with my editor.
Mm-hmm.
So I just take each part as far as I think it can go. I generally don't go back to it unless there's something wrong and it doesn't fit with some other thing because of later developments.
Right.
But I also write completely out of order. So in Time Traveler, I wrote the last couple scenes in the novel first. And so I always knew how it would end.
Yeah.
And that made it a lot easier to foreshadow things and work on where everything was headed.
Do your characters ever take a life of their own? Do they talk to you? Do they direct any of the action, give you ideas, or are they just totally under your thumb?
I think that's kind of a controversial thing.
Yeah.
I would say that the characters seem very much like real people to me.
Mm-hmm.
And if I try to do something that is not real with them, that generally they just, it just feels so implausible that you have to rethink. In Symmetry, there was, there's a character named Robert who's called upon to do things that he just doesn't want to do, and engineering the climax of that novel so that he would do the thing I needed him to do, there was a tremendous amount of setup that had to sort of slowly cut all his resistance away in order to make him do that thing. And so it's not that the characters have any say in the matter, but if you're forcing it, you should be able to feel that and correct it,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Interesting.
And you also have to change the characters sometimes to fit with the other characters.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, sometimes characters don't feel like they really belong in the same story. And then you have to do something about that.
Correct their chemistry.
Or just think, well, really, what would that person be like? I mean, if that sort of person was in that situation, really, what would they do? And sort of be honest, because something I've noticed with a lot of my students is that they create these wildly implausible situations and then invent people to do those things. And, you know, you just the reader after a while just balks and says, well, you know, come on.
Right, so. Right.
The thing with me is that I switched over from teaching mostly visual artists to teaching mostly writers.
Yeah.
So they seem different to me in terms of the kinds of tools they reach for and the kinds of stories they want to tell and what they want to make. It seems easier for visual artists to write than for writers to do visual things.
Mm-hmm.
That, I think, just has to do with the way our educational system is set up. I mean, all of us, no matter what we're going to become, we all get trained in reading and writing. So later on, when these photographers and book artists and painters want to write a short story, they know what it is, they know what it's supposed to feel like. I mean, they, you know, they usually need helpful hints, but a lot of them have taken creative writing classes. Whereas the writers, it's never seemed especially imperative to them that they learn how to draw,
mm-hmm.
for example. Like, why would you do that? Mm-hmm. What an oddball thing. So when we talk about, say, comics, to them, these comics artists seem like superstars from some other planet. Oh my God, I can't believe you can draw like that.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's interesting. I've occasionally done drawing lessons for the writers, and it blows them away that they can learn, that it's a skill you can acquire, that it's not just, you know, being touched by an angel and,
right.
You know,
in the DNA.
Yeah, and because I think when you're little kids, you know, everybody draws quite happily, and then there's this kind of sorting out where some kids are considered to be good at it, and so those kids generally keep going, and the kids who are not good at it just stop, because there's no reason to keep going. But, I mean, drawing is very meditative, and so I think people miss out on something kind of essential if they don't have a way to really see properly. There's a kind of attention that artists pay to the world, to the piece of paper, to what's in their head, what's in front of their eye, that I think writers would benefit from. Because writers are always trying to take the world and translate it into something very abstract, language. The artists are translating it into something equally abstract, but more closely resembling the thing that they're depicting.
Yeah.
And the words and the images in conjunction can do quite a lot that neither alone could do. So it seems like it would be very useful for more people to draw.
But what about the physical part, the physical book? What do you think the future of that is?
Well, I mean, I don't know what you can see with the camera, but we're sitting in a room full of books.
Yeah.
There's probably no books on camera.
No, there aren't.
A lot of the books that I collect, what I'm actually interested in is the form of the book.
By form, you mean what?
Can I get up and get a few books?
Sure.
All right. So, here we are with some books.
What is that?
So this is actually a sculptural book by my friend Melissa J. Craig.
By whom?
This is Melissa J. Craig. So, I don't know how well you can see this, but
pretty
this
well.
Is made of handmade paper. And inside are tiny little stubs of pages that have little green shoots, and essentially the thing looks like a kind of husk of a book. You know, it's almost like the book climbed out of its shell or molted or something.
Amazing.
So that's an example of a sculptural book. And then this is a fairly early edition of McSweeney's, the independently published magazine. One of the things I like about this is that they asked the band, They Might Be Giants, to make a song for every story in here. And so this comes with a CD. And I don't know what year this was, but this was kind of early. I was like, ooh, a CD. Now, of course, that's commonplace. But they instruct you at the beginning, they have a little thing telling you how you're supposed to experience this. So they have some very amusing instructions. For example, number 6, please note that you may listen to tracks without reading their pieces, and you may read pieces without listening to their corresponding tracks. But this is not recommended, you fucking bastard. So, you know, it's lovely and has all sorts of nice pictures and things that fall out of it. But it's still a book, you know, it's still recognizable as a book, and you would certainly not call it anything else.
Right.
So this is, you know, indie publishing at its finest, and of course they have a lot of lovely design and control over what they do. This is...
And that's a collaboration between artists and writers and...
And musicians.
Engineering.
Yeah. This is published by New Directions, which is a small press. This is Anne Carson's book, Knox. And when this came out, I was overjoyed because even though they published it commercially and it's all mechanically made. Anyway, so this is Knox by Anne Carson, and this is an accordion fold book. Oh. And she made an original, which had a lot of taped together, typewritten, hand-made things. And then, of course, there's the poem, and this all has to do with her brother, who left home kind of early and broke off most contact with the family, and so he died, and she...
Is it two-sided?
No. Oh. It's just kind of transparent, because we're looking.
Yeah,
but it's a really interesting read. I can't say that I understand all of it, but it's one of those things that kind of exists in layers and repays.
And it actually would fold into the other half of it.
Yeah, you could do this. Accordion fold books are really nice because there's lots and lots of ways to manipulate them and show them. For example, if you want to be tidy, you could just sit here and look at a spread in your lap and do that.
Wonderful.
But you could also take the whole thing and, you know, it would probably be about the length of this room.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this just delighted me no end, and I just thought New Directions was fantastic and brave for putting it out. They've done some beautiful, beautiful books.
Right.
And I just have this feeling that as the electronic books suck up the practical stuff, you know, the encyclopedias and dictionaries and romance novels and whatever else one might want to read in a sort of ephemeral way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you might want to read it once and you don't necessarily need to have it.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, the books that you want to have kind of have to be more interesting.
Right.
And so comics is burgeoning, book arts is becoming something that people, even if they don't know what it is, you start to share them and they say, oh yeah, that's interesting.
Mm.
Because, I mean, when artists are playing with books, they're thinking about the form and the content and how they relate and what you can do and how you can deform or change or amplify some quality of the book.
Exciting.
Yeah.
Where do you see it going?
I think that people will become more experimental and more playful with the physical books that actually get made, published, and that self-publishing obviously has gotten so easy. What isn't easy vis-a-vis self-publishing is how do you inform anybody that the book exists and how do you make them want to read it? So there's still this bottleneck in terms of the reader finding out about things. And of course, everybody only has so many hours in the day to read. So I have a feeling that as people self-publish more and more, they may not be getting the access to readers that they necessarily hoped for. I mean, on the other hand, it might be enough for some people if they have 100 readers. They might feel really great about that and have a good dialogue with their readers. If you're James Patterson, on the other hand, you might feel great about having, you know, 47 million readers or however many he has, I don't even know.
And then also there's the monetary aspect of that. Not just the readers, but how does one get remuneration to continue the art or to support the supplies. Is it too?
I mean, one thing that the internet lets people do is vote with their pocketbooks. I mean, there's the Radiohead model where you get to decide, you know, is it worth a penny? Is it worth $10?
Yeah.
I was kind of gratified because when Radiohead put out In Rainbows, they did that experiment, and the average amount that people paid was $8. And I thought, well, all right then, that could be okay. Mm. And of course, Radiohead got whatever amount of money it was. There was no middleman taking a cut. But of course, they're Radiohead.
Right.
If you're not Radiohead and you try that experiment, I suppose it depends on how many friends you have and how good they are at telling their friends. Or maybe you've made a clever video or something. It seems like the skills that are going to be important in the new world of writing, there might be a little bit more about being good at being videoed or something. I mean, just...
Or marketing savvy, or...
Yeah,
or
just, you know...
Communications.
I think the noise level will probably go up. You know how you go to a party and it starts off that you can actually hear people, and then as more and more people come and everybody raises their voices, and soon everybody's just shouting at each other and you can't hear a thing. I think that's kind of where we're headed. Everybody just screams louder and louder to get noticed, and it means nobody can hear. So that's a little worrisome, but I'm not sure what the remedy is. I mean, the nice thing about multiples, about mass reproduction, whether it's the physical book or the ebook or whatever, is that it gets out there. I mean, it goes and it has a life beyond the creator. And the readers, it's up to the readers. I mean, the readers have to take it and do something. I mean, they have to read it, they have to think about it, they have to talk about it, or it might as well not exist. I mean, you can only put it out there so far as a writer, and then somebody has to say, yes, thank you, I will take that now. And, you know, there's this active exchange between two people who almost never meet each other.
Well, Audrey, this has been really wonderful. And your insights with new materials and your own experiences and your...
Yeah, well, maybe we'll get some people to try making artist books.
I know.
Yes. That would be fun. I would love it if you guys... I could put you in touch with some book artists and they could show you some crazy things.
It'd be fun.
Oh, that would be
I would
cool.
love it.
Yeah.
It would be, I'd love that. And I have to say, this is one aspect to it, one of the things we stumbled on, is we keep meeting people who want to write books, not because they enjoy writing or have a story to tell, but they think they can make money.
Oops.
And I look at art books like these and think, someone is creating this sort of with a secondary thing in mind. Money may be there, but it's not what's driving it. It's just the passion of the art.
Oh, yeah. Well, certainly there are people who make money. I'm one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, readers.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
But on the other hand, I didn't make hardly any money at all until I was about 40. You know, because I had been slaving away in these very unremunerative portions of the art world. And it was also kind of an accident. I mean, I had this little indie publisher, and they were all completely flabbergasted that anybody bought this book. And, you know, we all said, yay, but it was a surprise. And I think, you know, if you set off writing a kind of formula thing, thinking that you're going to get rich, I mean, you might, people do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, look at some of this crazy 50 Shades of Grey thing. I mean, who knew that a lot of people wanted to read that crap? But anyway, and I was talking to my editor in London, his name is Dan Franklin, and we were kind of marveling over this phenomenon. And, you know, I mean, I haven't read more than a couple paragraphs of this that have been excerpted in reviews, but I'm thinking, well, gosh, I could write better smut than that. I mean, maybe I should give this a try, you know? But I don't know. I know life's short. but yeah, just... there's easier ways to make money, you know? I mean, just ways that are more straightforward and a sure bet. And, you know, I mean, a lot of people make more money working in the arts in kind of ancillary occupations, you know, being agents and gallerists and managers and publishers. I mean, there's so many ways to participate in this big cultural thing mm-hmm. without sitting there at the computer banging away, you know. I mean, so I people might say, oh, you know, I just want to make money, I don't care, but somewhere secretly in there, they must want that thing, you know, the satisfaction of being able to say, you know, yeah, I'm an author.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, being a teacher, you know, you see people in these kind of vulnerable situations where the book's not finished and yet they are still wrestling with it and it's got funky bits and good bits and, you know, here's your professor telling you, well, work on this, this isn't so good, this is better. And you have to sit there and critique and listen to everybody evaluate things and, you know, it's sort of not pretty, really. And I don't think people would do that unless they were serious.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you know, I mean...
Well, Audrey, we're at the end of the tape.
Okay.
We can't thank you enough.
It was fun.
All right, well, could have gone on for hours more, obviously. Wow. Thank you very much.
Give me enough coffee, I could talk forever.
There you go. Those 17 cups before we got here really worked out.
Yeah.